Her exact words, as I recall them, were, "There is no way." This hardly seemed like a flat refusal to me, and so I repeated the offer. "Come on," I said. "We're going to get ahead of the hurricane and sail back." Vicky said, "There is just no way." She was beginning to sound as though she might be serious. Full disclosure here. My wish to get Maya back to Hyannisport before the hurricane hit was not frivolous. I knew that if I left her on the Nantucket side, where there was little protection, the high winds and waves would smash her to pieces. This, in fact, was the fate of many boats caught on that stretch of land. Far better shielding awaited her on the Hyannis side, and I had no doubt that I could beat the big winds, which I did. I won't say that I was hurt by Vicky's refusal to trust me at the helm of a 50-foot boat, sailing across open water in the path of a Category 2 hurricane, but I didn't call her for 2 weeks. I was back in my office after Labor Day thinking of what excuse I was going to come up with to end my radio silence, when the secretary in my Washington office buzzed me with the message that I had a call waiting from Vicky Reggie. I think it was the first time she had ever originated a call to me. At the end of the conversation, I can't remember the exact topic, she'd called to wish me luck on something or other. I cleared my throat and said, "Well, listen, I was just thinking, I know you don't want to go out a lot because of your children, so, I thought I would come over to your house for dinner." From then on, I began going to Vicky's house for dinner nearly every night, as often as my schedule would allow. Some evenings I arrived early and had the chance to spend fun time with Curran and Caroline before their mother got home from work. Sometimes I would bring friends of mine along with me, and Vicky would obligingly cook for them as well. She loves to cook, and with her southern roots and Lebanese heritage, she really turns out some delicious meals. Vicky would put the children to bed around 8, and as she came back down the stairs, we would often hear them calling, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy." The first time this happened, Vicky began to apologize for it, but I interrupted her. "Oh, no," I said. "I think a child calling for his mother is the most beautiful sound in the world." We really had an old-fashioned courtship, and I loved it that way. During those autumn evenings, Vicky and I would talk as she cooked. We talked during dinner, and then after dinner, we'd talk some more. I usually headed back to my house by 10:30 or so. We both had work the next day, and Vicky had to get the children off to school in the morning as well. But I knew we'd be together the next evening anyway. We really took the time to know each other, and we grew very close. As the months went on, I realized that I loved this woman very deeply, and that my love for her was overcoming all the defenses I'd built up in myself against the potential heartbreak of marrying again. One night, as Vicky and I were listening to La Boheme, we both love opera, I asked whether she wanted to go to New York to hear it performed. She quickly agreed. But the date for the performance was 2 months away. I had decided to propose to Vicky at the opera, but I wanted to surprise her. So I waited for 2 months, and in the meantime, I made sure that we spent more time with my children and my sisters and sisters-in-law. I asked Vicky to marry me, and she said yes, during the performance of La Boheme at the Metropolitan Opera in New York on January 14, 1992. We decided to keep our engagement quiet for a while we worked out the plans for our wedding. In mid-March, I felt the time had come to tell Kara, Teddy, and Patrick, and Vicky felt she should tell Curran and Caroline, too. Everyone was asked to keep the wonderful news to themselves, but secrecy was too much to ask of then-6-year-old Caroline. She only told one person in her kindergarten class, and he told his parents, who apparently worked for the Washington Post. We announced our engagement in March, and I gave Vicky an engagement ring in April when we were visiting my sister Pat, who had rented a house for Easter in St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. We were snorkeling at Buck Island Reef, named by President Kennedy to be part of the National Park System in 1961, where I placed the ring for Vicky to find near a coral head. I'm just thankful that a big grouper didn't swim away with the ring before she saw it. Our wedding, a private ceremony with our immediate families, took place at my McLean house on July 3, 1992. As a wedding gift to my bride, I did an oil painting of daffodils. The two of us had been reading William Wordsworth's poem Daffodils together several weeks earlier, and it was one of the readings we chose for our wedding. The poem goes, "I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. The wildflowers lift the poet's spirits and charm him by the way they seem to dance in the wind in a long line beside a bay. When later he lies in solitude on his couch, the image of the flowers returns to him. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils." Chapter 22. Campaigning for Political Survival, 1994. In 1994, after 32 years in the Senate, I found myself campaigning for my political survival. I knew that this election was going to be more challenging than usual, so I had been laying the groundwork for more than 2 years, actively campaigning around the state for other candidates in the 1992 elections, and reconnecting with voters who had not seen me for a while. After those elections, I continued to return to the Commonwealth as much as the Senate schedule allowed to meet with various constituency groups and visit more cities and towns. But despite our hard work, there were red flags. When campaign workers were gathering signatures to qualify me for the ballot, they found the electorate to be less receptive than in other years. A changing world had transformed Massachusetts into a quite different state from the one I'd known as a boy, or even as a young senator. Textiles and shoes had been the twin anchors of the Commonwealth's economic stability and working-class hopes back in Honey Fitz's day. But the red brick factories and mills that once seemed as natural to the landscape as cranberry bogs had been declining even before World War II, and now were shuttered, losers to outsourcing and overseas competition. Mass production of shoes in America had begun in Lynn, Massachusetts in 1885, but Ronald Reagan's favorite, the Bostonian, was being made in China and India now. Massachusetts textile mills had virtually ushered in the American industrial age, but Asian imports were rendering this industry uncompetitive as well. As with any shrinkage of a job base, decline built on decline. Machine shops, mold makers, and electricians were drawn down into the spiral. Lower wages, unemployment, a shrinking tax base that supported fewer social services and funding for schools. It was enough to turn good people angry and cynical. And it had. Massachusetts is a resilient state, and it wheeled about to stem the flow of lost jobs and revenues. Its network of higher learning centers began to draw in a new kind of worker, the white-collar professional in information, finance, biotech, and other high-tech jobs. Yet as welcome as these were, these new economy specialists could not fully compensate for the losses. New anxieties arose in the streets and neighborhoods, and were augmented by the rise of welfare and its perceived abuses. "What is Senator Kennedy doing about it?" ran the question in those neighborhoods. "Where is he? Why isn't he around here?" Reasonable questions, all of them, and to some, there were reasonable answers. But as Vicky and members of my staff tried to remind me from time to time, I was not in the habit of touting my accomplishments. As a woman legislator urged Vicky during the campaign, "Honey, you've just got to tell him what my mama told me. If you don't toot your horn, nobody's going to hear your tune." Well, I was taught not to toot my own horn. The last time I tried it, I'd gotten a letter from Dad telling me to stop mooing. But eventually, I had to face up to the larger point in that criticism. I could no longer assume that the voters were closely monitoring my hard work on their behalf. For one thing, I was not even especially well known to the newer, younger electorate, which had little investment in Boston's or the state's past. The name Ted Kennedy conveyed less information and less political connection to them than perhaps I would like to have thought. For another, even my older base was perhaps starting to take me for granted, or if Vicky was to be believed, taking me for granite. "You've become like a building to them," she told me one day. I soon grasped that my wife was handing me a hard and urgent truth. Her own conversations with people around the state had convinced her that to many, I'd become less a human being than a kind of monument, and that among those who did have strong opinions was a sizable percentage that didn't think I understood the problems and concerns of people like them. I had also contributed to my political problems by persistent questions about my personal behavior, which were raised by the media during the Senate's confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas, and, more notoriously, in coverage of allegations of a date rape in Palm Beach. On March 30, 1991, my nephew William Smith was accused of the crime, and I was named in tabloid stories because I had been with him earlier that evening. The episode interrupted what I'd hoped would be a quiet getaway from my Senate duties, a weekend at the house my father had purchased in 1933. My son Patrick and I joined my sister Jean, her four children, and other friends in Palm Beach for Easter. William was 30 that spring and a medical student at Georgetown University School of Medicine. He would go on to a productive career as an activist in the worldwide cause of finding and disabling military landmines. He founded the Center for International Rehabilitation, a network for supporting the disabled. William, Patrick, and I had left the house and gone out for a late evening drink at a popular Palm Beach watering hole. As I later told a jury, we had all spent much of the day and evening reminiscing about Steve Smith, who had recently died of cancer shortly before his 63rd birthday. Steve had managed or helped manage the presidential campaigns of Jack, Bobby, and me. He had taken over the family finances after my father died, becoming chairman of our family business office in New York. He spearheaded the fundraising for the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston, of which the Stephen E. Smith Center became a part. Beyond his accomplishments in the world, Steve was a gentle and humorous man beneath his facade of intensity. He was a good soul, and I loved him very much. My memories of Steve and other lost family members overwhelmed me as I tried to fall asleep. I invited Patrick and William to come with me to the club. William struck up a conversation with a woman, and he and she left the establishment. Out of that encounter came the woman's charge against William. Her claim, of course, made headlines and news broadcasts around the world. Ultimately, the jury wound up deliberating for only 77 minutes before delivering a verdict of not guilty. I could have avoided any involvement in the trial if I'd simply taken a walk on the beach by myself that night, instead of asking my son and nephew to accompany me to a bar. Clarence Thomas, however, was another matter entirely. That was a controversy I could not avoid. On July 1, 1991, President Bush nominated Thomas, a federal judge, to the Supreme Court to fill the seat of the great Thurgood Marshall. Marshall had been the first African American to serve as a Supreme Court justice. It seemed generally obvious that the president had been determined to select a black jurist to succeed Marshall, and a conservative black jurist at that. The National Organization for Women objected to his nomination immediately. They focused on indications that he might vote to overturn Roe v. Wade, thus criminalizing abortion and denying women the right to make their own reproductive decisions. The NAACP and the Urban League objected sometime later. They pinpointed critical statements Thomas had made about affirmative action. Worst of all, however, was Thomas's rating by the American Bar Association's 15-member evaluation committee for appointees. No member gave him the highest rating of well-qualified. Two of them even pronounced him unqualified. In stark contrast, every other sitting member of the Supreme Court has been determined to be well-qualified by the ABA. President Bush's earlier assertion that Thomas was the best qualified nominee available hardly seemed credible. As a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by Joe Biden, which began hearings on Thomas's appointment on September 10th, the questioning went on for 8 sessions spanning 17 days, focusing on the nominee's opinions about issues such as the right to privacy, civil and minority rights, and his record as Equal Employment Opportunity Commission chairman, among other topics. On September 27th, the Judiciary Committee was evenly split on whether to recommend his confirmation. 7 votes for his confirmation and 7 against. In voting against confirmation, I said that when ideology is the paramount consideration of the president in nominating a justice to the Supreme Court, the Senate is entitled to take that ideology into account in the confirmation process and to reject any nominee whose views are so extreme that they place him outside the mainstream. We sent the nomination to the Senate floor without a recommendation. On October 6th, as the full Senate body neared the end of its deliberations, 2 news outlets broke a story that threw the proceedings and the nation into an uproar. A tenured professor at the University of Oklahoma Law Center, Anita Hill, had submitted to our committee in September an affidavit stating that Thomas had sexually harassed her 10 years earlier while she was employed as his personal assistant at the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education, which he then headed. Specifically, Ms. Hill charged, Thomas had discussed pornographic movies with her and had asked her several times for a date, even after she told him she did not wish to go out with him. The Judiciary Committee reopened its hearings on October 11th, and that is when the media and much of America suddenly developed a consuming interest in our deliberations. In defending himself, Thomas famously and furiously described his questioning as a circus and a national disgrace, a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks who in any way deign to think for themselves. On October 15th, the full Senate confirmed Clarence Thomas as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court by a vote of 52-48, mostly but not entirely along party lines. A sort of urban legend built up around my participation, or lack of participation, in the questioning of Clarence Thomas during the Anita Hill portion of the hearings. The idea took hold that I remained mostly silent, muzzled myself, in the words of at least one journalist, because I was reluctant to interrogate the nominee on the question of his alleged sexual harassment of Hill. It would draw attention to my private life, especially in the wake of the Palm Beach incident. The true reason why I did not ask many questions is less melodramatic and more procedural. Joe Biden had appointed Howard Heflin of Alabama and Patrick Leahy of Vermont, a former prosecutor, as the lead questioners of Thomas for this added-on stage of the hearings, which were out of the ordinary and subject to different rules. I had been a regular questioner in the main part of the hearings, and I don't think anyone doubted my performance then. I was not at all reluctant to raise my voice. On day three of this phase, I angrily spoke up in protest of what I called the character assassination of Anita Hill. I made a strong statement at the end, as I voted in opposition to Thomas's confirmation. I worked to garner votes to turn down his nomination. I let it be known that I thought he was the wrong man for the job, because of his narrow view of the Constitution and his judicial philosophy. But I also knew, and know, that perception is reality in politics. I had appeared to be silenced, and no amount of rational explanation about procedural mechanics was going to change that reality. I also understood another hard truth. With all of the background noise about Palm Beach and my bachelor lifestyle, I would have been the wrong person to be a lead questioner in the second phase of the Thomas hearing. And I know that many people were disappointed that I was unable to succeed in making a persuasive case against Thomas's confirmation. That autumn was a time of soul-searching for me. The Palm Beach incident and the Clarence Thomas hearings, each in its own way, but really together, had stirred up public doubts about my past and my judgment. For the first time, my private life was viewed as impacting my public life. The high stakes of the Clarence Thomas nomination and the salacious allegations about his private life and its impact on his professional life certainly did not help that perception. My habitual reluctance to speak publicly about my personal life had intensified the doubting of many and had allowed the latest tabloid frenzy to roll on unabated with rumor and innuendo. I needed to reestablish good faith with my constituents. I began work on a speech to address the issues in a way I had never done before. It was not an easy one to write or give. I asked Vicky to accompany me to the speech and then to join me and my family at the Cape for the rest of the weekend. I told her that I was giving an important speech at Harvard, but I didn't tell her what I would say or why I wanted her to be there. Her presence was all I needed. On October 25th, with Vicky sitting amid the capacity audience, I took the microphone at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Television cameras focused their lenses on me from behind the packed auditorium. Late arrivals milled outside, unable to find seats. Many, I later gathered, had come because they expected me to announce a decision not to seek another term in the Senate. I spoke of the nation's pressing policy issues for several minutes. National health insurance, gun control, civil rights. I alluded to the outrage of many progressive Americans at the confirmation of Thomas to the Supreme Court. Some of the anger of recent days reflects the pain of a new idea still being born. The idea of a society where sex discrimination is ended and sexual harassment is unacceptable. The idea of an America where the majority who are women are truly and finally equal citizens. Then, shifting my focus to another source of recent public anger, I turned to the heart of what I'd come to say. I am painfully aware, I told my audience, that the criticism directed at me in recent months involves far more than honest disagreements with my positions, or the usual criticism from the far right. It also involves the disappointment of friends and many others who rely on me to fight the good fight. I looked around the auditorium and continued, in matter-of-fact tones. To them I say, I recognize my own shortcomings, the faults in the conduct of my private life. I realize that I alone am responsible for them, and I am the one who must confront them. I believe that each of us, as individuals, must not only struggle to make a better world, but to make ourselves better too. And in this life, those endeavors are never finished. After the speech, I was relieved, but I knew it was only the beginning. I had work to do. That evening, after a quiet dinner, I asked Vicky to take a walk with me. I wanted to show her some of the things that make Boston such a special place for me. We walked through the public garden and through the common, jewels in Boston's emerald necklace. The magnificent park system created by Frederick Law Olmsted. We walked up Chestnut Street, where I showed her the buildings designed by Charles Bulfinch, the same architect who had designed the U.S. Capitol and the church, though I didn't know it at the time, at which my beloved mother eventually would be buried. I showed Vicky Lewisburg Square, where citizens of Irish descent had gathered to challenge my grandfather when he appointed an Italian-American to a post, shouting, "Remember your own, Honey Fitz! Remember your own!" I always saw any campaign as an education, for me and for the voters. But I hadn't gone through especially competitive elections for a while, and the voters didn't know what I'd been doing in the Senate. They knew about all of the tabloid fodder, but not about the serious hard work of legislating and the many successes we had. I faced some other troubling fires of discontent that burned in Massachusetts and the nation. There was increasing unhappiness with the status quo and a strong aversion to incumbency. Term limits was the cure-all of the moment. The Republicans' Gingrich Revolution, which in 1994 would claim a net 54 House seats and 8 in the Senate, was forming. Right-wing talk radio was on the rise, lending fury to the general discontent. There were reasons enough for discontent. People were hurting in my state and all across the country. The rhetoric by political leaders was to demonize the poor as people getting something for nothing. Gingrich was calling America a welfare state, but the policies he was proposing were heartless. And my likely Republican opponent was right out of central casting, young, tall, handsome, slender, with a beautiful wife and 5 attractive sons. Mitt Romney had a Harvard MBA and a fortune that he was prepared to spend. The son of George W. Romney, the former Michigan governor and 1968 Republican presidential candidate, Mitt was 47 in 1994 and a legend in Boston financial circles. His private equity investment firm, Bain Capital, boasted a 113% average annual rate of return on investments. He'd never before won or even sought a political seat of any kind, but in 1994, this was held to be a good thing. In fact, one political analyst described him, for this very reason among others, as the ideal candidate, a newcomer to politics, 45 to 50 years old, without any skeletons in his closet, a record of entrepreneurial success in the private sector, socially liberal, fiscally conservative. The analyst went on, "A critical mass of the voters are either like that themselves or aspire to that role. Mitt Romney at this point appears to fit that profile." His TV ads cast me, by contrast, as old and tired. "Time to retire, old Ted. Say thank you, give him a gold watch, and let him spend his dotage on Cape Cod." At least that's how Romney started out. He also made a point of repeating that I had never held a real job. I had certainly heard that old saw before, but never from a candidate quite as eager and confident and charged up as Mitt. Mitt ran as the man with a Mr. Clean image, whose hard work had blessed him with a fortune, and who was now going to give something back by bringing good, honest business principles to the messy game of politics. I remember one newspaper profile of him that described him as singing only hymns and as having even his dog kneel down for nightly prayers. I watched his media performance at a distance through the summer of 1994, getting ready as usual to transition into my own post-Labor Day campaigning after an unusually busy Senate year that ran through August. In May, after discussion with many Republicans, I'd proposed a compromise version of President Clinton's health care bill, a markup of existing legislation that would help assure coverage to workers who had lost or changed jobs. The effort had foundered in June after late partisan bickering undercut what had seemed a good chance for the bill's success. I had worked to draft the Goals 2000 legislation, which stimulated and supported local school reform efforts, including setting high standards for what students should learn. My efforts won broad bipartisan support. Working with the president, I'd led successful Senate efforts to pass the Family and Medical Leave Act and the School to Work Opportunities Act. I'd also spearheaded the Crime Act, which put 10,000 new policemen on America's streets and imposed tough new penalties for crimes involving gangs and firearms. I ran ads in June and July, the earliest I had ever done so. It was a substantial buy, but I went dark in August. That was a mistake. Mitt Romney's TV spots that summer were nominally geared to winning the September 20th primary against his fellow businessman, John Lakian, whom he in fact defeated easily. But there was no mistaking the real target, me. Aggressive, slickly packaged, and frequent, they must have taken a good chunk out of his $7 million campaign budget, more spending than was usual for any campaign in Massachusetts. But were they getting him any traction? I doubted it. The ads boasted of Mitt's supposed success as a job-creating business executive, a success he promised to replicate as a senator. He was positioning himself as a moderate, almost an apolitical candidate. He was pro-choice, he declared. But efficiency was what he really had to sell. Sleeves rolled up, business-like efficiency, to replace the senior senator's outdated ways. He called for an end to rewarding children who have children by terminating support for welfare mothers who gave birth out of wedlock while on benefits. This stand of his posed a sticky challenge to me, at least as some of my aides saw it. Romney was not alone in denouncing welfare. It was a convenient issue in 1994. People were hurting in my state and all across the country. Newt Gingrich was at the peak of his power, touting the Republicans' contract with America and steering his party to a rout of Democrats in the midterm elections. Thus, the rhetoric of demonizing the poor as people getting something for nothing was especially effective this year, and some on my staff worried that my support of it could jeopardize my chances. Just before Labor Day, my campaign manager and nephew, Michael Kennedy, called Vicky to say that the Boston Herald was going to publish a poll showing Mitt Romney and me virtually tied. Together, they called our campaign pollster, Tom Kiley, to see what he thought of the poll, and he agreed that it was accurate. Then they called me with the news, "You and Mitt are dead even." That got my attention. My Senate campaigns in the past had followed the timetable that Jack had formulated back in the 1950s. "Look," he used to tell me, "everybody goes away in August. They're not paying much attention. They start caring after Labor Day when vacation is over and the kids are back in school. And if the Red Sox are doing well, they're not going to focus on the election until after the pennant races. That's when they start making up their minds." In 1994, the Senate business certainly did not go away in August. I divided my time between the critical legislative battles I've described above and getting the Kennedy campaign organization revved up for another go. We reactivated our trusty old troops and brought in promising newcomers. An effective political campaign force is a bit like an army, large, well-trained, disciplined, with varying and complex missions, and overseen by a tight chain of command. As with my Senate staff, I have been lucky with the quality of my campaign personnel through the years. This time around, they would be tested more intensely than usual. On Labor Day, polls showed that the race was even-steven. I called a meeting at our Back Bay apartment on September 18th to discuss our strategy with Bob Schrum, John Sasso, Paul Kirk, Tom Kiley, Michael Kennedy, and other top campaign aides. Vicky and her father, Edmund Reggie, who had been so helpful in my brother's campaigns, were also there. I listened as they made their presentations and recommendations. Up until that point, for 32 years of public life, I had never mentioned my opponent in a campaign ad. But times had changed, and my Republican opponents had been running ads against me while I remained silent. Those ads had obviously taken their toll. Schrum, pointing out that we could not attack my opponent's voting record because there was no record to attack, argued strongly that Romney's business practices were fair game. His business was to take over and invest in other companies, and it was in that arena where we should go searching for clues to the kind of judgments he would bring to bear in representing the people as their United States senator. Vicky strongly agreed with this, and I gave my go-ahead. In addition, I was advised to take a position in favor of so-called welfare reform. Romney had made a point of being opposed to additional benefits being given to single mothers who had more children. None of us wanted to reward irresponsibility, but who were we punishing? It seemed to me that we would be hurting innocent babies who needed assistance. I told my staff that I was not going to try to win this election on the backs of poor women and children. Case closed. After the meeting, I got on the phone and asked Randy Cooper, my extremely capable former chief of staff, to take a leave of absence from her private sector job to join the campaign. Randy had run my office for many years. She knew me, knew how to get things done. And if she were there, I knew I wouldn't have to worry about anything. And then there was Dave Burke. Dave had also been my trusted chief of staff at an earlier time. When he wrote to offer to help in any way he could, I don't think he ever expected me to follow up in quite the way I did. Dave had been the president of CBS News and had had a very successful private sector career. I doubt that he thought he was volunteering to leave his beautiful wife, Trixie, for 6 weeks to live out of a suitcase to be my body man. But that's exactly what I asked him to do. I needed a peer to ride in the car with me, someone who knew me and had good judgment. There were press stakeouts at every campaign stop. There were constantly changing issues of the day. I needed a trusted aide to bounce ideas off of. Dave was the man. Vicky was usually campaigning on her own during the day, but she joined us for the evening events. And I have to say that with Dave and Vicky, my mood was lighter every day. I always enjoyed campaigning, but we were really having fun. Vicky, meanwhile, had been busy developing another new campaign avenue for me. We had decided actively and energetically to pursue the women's vote. Women had been brought into the political process by the Clinton campaign like never before, and Vicky wanted to harness that energy and enthusiasm for our campaign, and she did. With trusted aide Lisa McBurney, Vicky began meeting with professional women in Massachusetts as early as 1993. She was a natural. As women in that group have since told me, she was one of them, swapping stories of working motherhood and even talking about how we met. While I have never been at ease discussing such things, Vicky apparently chatted about our courtship and the children, and she listened to the stories of women who have since become her very good friends. My formerly granite exterior was falling away as voters began to connect with me through Vicky's eyes. For all of her natural ability and love of politics, Vicky had never been on the campaign trail before. But with Angela Menino, the much-loved and politically savvy wife of Boston Mayor Tom Menino, as her guide, Vicky plunged in. In the evenings, the two of us would laugh over the war stories we accumulated along the way, about being in a parade and seeing people give me the finger, or even worse, young people with no expression at all. They had no idea who I was. Vicky told me about how many times Angela would introduce her to a woman and ask, "Would you like to meet Mrs. Kennedy?" and the woman would say, "No, thank you." She'd ask, "Angela, what do I say?" And Angela said, "You just ask them for their vote. Say you hope they'll be able to support your husband, and if they say no, say, 'Well, I hope you'll give a consideration.'" But then there were wonderful little moments that gave both of us such joy. We were at a Lebanese festival in the northeast part of the state when an elderly Lebanese woman came up to Vicky, pulled her aside, and asked, "So, honey, is he good to you?" Vicky said, "Yes, he is good to me." The woman asked, "Do you love him?" Vicky said she loved me. And then the most important question of all, "Does he eat Lebanese food?" Vicky said, "Yes, I did. I loved Lebanese food." Then, in what Vicky described as the comforting tones of Arabic-accented English that reminded my wife of her beloved grandmother, and while making the sign of the cross, the old woman said, "Okay, honey, I'm going to vote for him for the first time in my life." How we both love that story. Our campaign days were long, and I was still keeping a busy Senate schedule back in Washington. So Vicky and Michael Kennedy were surrogates for me at events around the state, and I had extraordinary assistance and support from my fellow Democrats in the congressional delegation and from local elected officials. The governor was a Republican, but the Senate president, Bill Bulger, and Speaker of the House, Charlie Flattery, were in my corner, and they rallied their troops in a meaningful and effective way. Boston Mayor Tom Menino was also tremendously helpful. I remember gathering in his basement one night in the spring of 1994 as he brought his organization together for pasta and a pep talk. When he finished, I was ready to go out and campaign for myself in the cold. The friendship and support of these dedicated officials is something I'll never forget. Tip O'Neill was right that all politics is local. And these political leaders had their fingers on the local pulse. Along with them and the state representatives and state senators and mayors all around the Commonwealth that welcomed us and encouraged their supporters to join our effort, we were able to build a successful organization. The Senate was in session for most of August that year, so I didn't have the month to hit the ground as usual. I was chairman of the committee that was churning out much of the important legislation, and I didn't want to be absent. I believed that my constituents would be pleased that I was doing the people's business, but the truth was that they were being bombarded with advertisements from the Republican Senate primary essentially aimed at me, and other than weekends, I wasn't there to counteract the impact. So the local officials and the revitalized organization and surrogates were more important than ever that summer. Vicky would come back from the campaign trail and regale me with the tales of her adventures. She loved campaigning, and as she said to me, she loved most of all sharing the stories with me at the end of the day. At a popular restaurant in Boston, where you had to shout to be heard above the din of the crowd, a campaign worker asked a woman diner, "How would you like to meet Mrs. Ted Kennedy?" The woman looked up and said, without missing a beat, "Not as pretty as the first one." Vicky smiled and said, "Thank you so much. I hope you'll support my husband." Vicky loved that story and used it to tease me to no end about the sacrifices she made for me. And then she would dissolve into laughter. Yes, I loved this woman. She told me about a man at another table who replied to her greeting with, "Kennedy? I wouldn't vote for him if you paid me to." Then he remembered his manners. "But it's nice to meet you, ma'am." In Worcester, a few days later, a fellow deflected her, "I hope you'll support my husband" greeting with the off-center retort, "I only support people who are French." "Ah," Vicky said. "Then you'll want to support my husband, Ted Kennedy." They both started laughing. She believed she won him over with that one. When I was able to be there, I had my own interesting encounters that were a bit different from previous campaigns. The tenor of some of the questions fired at me at events left no doubt that the electorate was angry. People were hurting. But there were still the fun times, singing Irish songs in senior centers, eating food at the ethnic festivals, walking in the parades. Those are the things that bring you close to the people and make politics fun. They're a long way from the more modern campaign staples of television advertising and the internet, but they're every bit as important, at least for me. I wouldn't trade the people part of politics for anything in the world. The Senate finally recessed on October 8th, and I was able to be in Massachusetts full time. Vicky's mother, Doris, basically relocated to our home in Virginia to help look after the children. Curran was 11, and Caroline was 8, and the separation was especially hard on them and on Vicky. But having Doris there helped ease the burden. We began to feel momentum as I was able to get around the state. As one state rep put it, "People just want to see your shoe leather hit the pavement," and hit the pavement we did. I gained some impressive backup. My nephew, John Kennedy, accompanied by his large German shepherd, Sam, joined the campaign and brought crowds to their feet with his infectious charm and witty but impassioned message. Another nephew, Chris Lawford, then playing a heartthrob in a popular daytime soap opera, created quite a stir wherever he went. Other nieces and nephews, and of course our own children, hit the trail. The actor Alec Baldwin went to college campuses to register new voters. President Clinton and Hillary both came to the state to stump for me. They were both enormously popular and were great assets. Meanwhile, we were matching Mitt Romney's sizable treasure chest with resources of our own, eventually spending upwards of $10 million. I mortgaged my house as part of the effort so I could spend more time campaigning and less time fundraising in those important last weeks. That meant we would have an aggressive fundraising schedule to retire debt after the election, but that was fine with me. It was money well and wisely spent. Much of it supported the political TV spots created by Bob Schrum and his team. Bob and Vicky's intuition about probing Romney's corporate behavior proved brilliantly on target. It led to the most effective negative ad that we ran. The ad went directly to Romney's claim that he had created 10,000 jobs. From there, it went to the single word AMPAD, which came to define his true record as a businessman. Our campaign had received a call from a union representative telling us about the takeover of an Indiana company by AMPAD, Romney's Bain Capital subsidiary, and AMPAD's subsequent firing or slashing of salary and benefits of most of the workers. Schrum's partner, Tad Devine, went out to Indiana to film the workers, and he threw away the script and just let them tell their stories. My dad always said there's no substitute for sincerity, and these people, working people who were losing their health insurance and their jobs, spoke from the heart. One especially effective ad ended with a middle-aged female worker looking directly into the camera saying, "I'd like to say to the people of Massachusetts, if you think it can't happen to you, think again, because we thought it couldn't happen here either." Our first televised debate at Faneuil Hall was in the final week of October. With Romney's poll lead decreasing and the truth of his job creation record in deep question, Mitt had realigned himself a little. He'd moved away from his businessman strategy and begun to campaign almost as a liberal reformer. I had begun to joke at rallies that I had heard of flip and I had heard of flop, but with Mitt, it was flip, flop, flip. He'd changed positions so often that if we gave him a little more time, he'd be voting for me on election day. Yes, I was having fun. Still, I knew that a lot was riding on the outcome of the debate in Faneuil Hall. Romney was slipping, but things remained close. I was taking nothing for granted. This was a change year. People all over the country were itching for change, and Massachusetts was no exception. Term limits were in vogue. Mitt had talked about thanking me for my service and sending me home to Cape Cod to retire. He was young and slender, and I was not. Would his message resonate in a face-to-face meeting? We were about to find out. When the day arrived, Vicky and I went to the Kennedy Library and sat outside in the back. We ate sandwiches, and I pored over my briefing materials. We went back to our apartment, and I took a nap so I'd be at peak energy for the intensity of the give and take. By evening, I was prepared, but nervous. During the drive to Faneuil Hall, Dave Burke perceived that I was a little tense, and he did his best to lighten me up. Dave is great, a superb mind, a loyal aide and friend over the decades, and a fellow who knows the value of laughter. From the time we got in the car, Dave and Vicky made fast patter to keep the mood light. Dave grilled us about the most important thing we had learned in the campaign, then provided the answer himself, that the Roy Rogers on the Mass Pike didn't serve fried chicken until 11 a.m. We laughed so much at that one, as it conjured up memories of long days crisscrossing the state and craving that chicken before the appointed hour. As we neared the hall, Dave tapped me on the shoulder. "I just want to know why Steve Breyer is sitting on the Supreme Court," he asked in mock seriousness, "and I'm sitting in this damn car with you." I laughed and relaxed even more, but then I looked out of the window and any remaining nervousness vanished. I saw a huge swell of people stretching for blocks. They carried Kennedy signs and chanted, "Teddy, Teddy, Teddy." It was like the old torchlight parades that Grandpa used to tell me about and that he loved so much. I rolled down the car window, leaned out, raised my arm, and pumped my fist. My adrenaline was flowing. These were my people. They were working people. They were the people I had been representing for 32 years, and we still had work to do. As I stepped out of the car, onto the cobblestone street and into Faneuil Hall, I couldn't help but think of the history of the place. From meetings to plan the Revolutionary War, to my brother Jack's last campaign speech in 1960, to more modern gatherings. This building, the cradle of liberty, was at the center of it all. As Mitt and I took the stage, I noticed two exceptionally large podiums. For some reason, unlike every other election, I had been unable to lose weight this time, and I was at an all-time high. As I found out later, my dear friend Eddie Martin got into the hall and swapped the smaller podiums for two larger ones, masking my size and totally dwarfing poor Mitt. Eddie never told me what he did, and it was only years later, at the time of his death, that I learned the true story. I remember the first question I was asked in the debate. "Why is this race even close?" My first thought was, "Good question. I'm wondering the same thing." My next thought was, "I'd better start talking and hope I think of something pretty soon." So I started talking and was relieved when my time was up. Both Mitt and I were prepared. Both of us kept our composure, and both of us remained hyper-alert for an opening, any opening. I saw one when Mitt gave a long-winded, nuanced answer about supposedly being pro-choice. Unlike his professed anti-choice stance as a candidate for the Republican nomination for president in 2008. I paused for a beat and said, "I am pro-choice. My opponent is multiple choice." The crowd laughed. No one laughed, however, least of all me, when I was asked about how I coped with my personal failings. There it was. The unspoken was spoken. My personal life was on the table. And unlike other questions and answers that I had reviewed with my advisors during debate prep, this was an area that we did not cover. This one was all mine. I had thought about it, to be sure. I knew what I felt inside. But to have to say it in public was my challenge. I decided to place my trust in the simple, unadorned truth. I paused a moment and then began, "Every day of my life, I try to be a better human being, a better father, a better son, a better husband. And since my life has changed with Vicky, I believe the people of this state understand that the kind of purpose and direction and new affection and confidence on personal matters has been enormously reinvigorating. And hopefully, I am a better senator." And then they asked Mitt Romney, and his unfortunate tone deafness became evident to everyone. After making an ineffective attempt at humor, I assume you mean my weakness, he started to talk about how much he loved to volunteer and how his life had been about being able to give service to others. He went on in that way for so long that the moderator felt compelled to remind him that he was asked about his greatest weakness. By the end of the evening, after I tried to pin Romney down on the specific costs of his health care proposals, after he became exasperated with me for asking for specifics and I shot back, "That's what you have to do as a legislator, Mr. Romney." After he complained about my ads and I told him that we could discuss that after the debate because people were hurting and they wanted to hear about issues that affected their lives, I started to feel that things were going okay for me. And you could feel in the room that the crowd was feeling that way too. My nephew, Congressman Joe Kennedy, told me that the next day people were crossing the street to shake his hand, congratulating him on the great debate. But, he said, he really knew we'd done well when they put their arm around his shoulders and whispered in his ear, "I've been with your uncle the whole time." On Election Day, I won by a margin of 58% to Romney's 41%. The next morning, Vicky and I woke up early to meet commuters coming into Park Street Station in Boston. "We just wanted to say thank you. The results around the country had not been so positive. Close friends and colleagues of mine had lost their seats in a Republican tsunami. But thanks to the people of Massachusetts, I was going back to Washington." A lot of people have asked me since then whether the Romney race was my most difficult. It wasn't. It was competitive. Clearly the most competitive since Eddie McCormick. But it wasn't difficult because I knew where I stood. I knew what I believed. I knew what I needed to do. And I was determined to do what I needed to do in terms of the hard campaigning, but not to trim down my positions and beliefs, even if they seemed out of favor that year. At the end of the day, I was running to do something I cared about that would make a difference in people's lives, not just to hold an office. And I was sharing the campaign with Vicky, the love of my life and my soulmate. I also felt that I benefited from the good memories that many people in the state, particularly in Boston, still had of Grandpa Fitzgerald and my mother. Both Grandpa and my mother loved the personal side of politics, and their connections to the people ran deep. In 1994, my 104-year-old mother was still a presence, if not in the public square anymore, certainly in the public's heart. At the same time, the people of my state revered the memory of President Kennedy, their native son, and they remembered Bobby. I recognized that I stood on the shoulders of all of them, and that I had benefited from the goodwill that they enjoyed. We had a joyful Thanksgiving celebration that year. As always, we gathered at our home in Hyannisport. We had two wonderful new additions at the Thanksgiving table that year. Kylie Elizabeth Kennedy, the 3-month-old daughter of my son Teddy and his wife Kiki, and Grace Kennedy Allen, the 2-month-old daughter of my daughter Kara and her husband Michael. Joined by my mother, we were 4 generations of Kennedys gathered around the dinner table in the home that has always been such a refuge for me. I was a very happy man. The next evening, the celebration continued. And in addition to our children, we were joined for dinner by Vicky's parents, Paul and Gail Kirk, and Eddie and Marge Martin. Vicky had prepared her usual post-Thanksgiving fare, turkey gumbo, in honor of her Louisiana roots, and turkey tetrazzini, which was a favorite of Michael Allen's, and wine was flowing as everyone was toasting me and congratulating me on the win. I don't like attention directed to me in that way, as loving as it was, so I stood up and began, "Well, this victory really isn't about me. It's about my family, and it's about the people of Massachusetts and their residual goodwill that goes all the way back to Grandpa's day." Suddenly, Vicky was on her feet, cutting me off. "Please excuse my language, but bullshit!" That got everyone's attention. She went on, "This is just ridiculous." She paused to let that sink in, and I stared back at her. Then she said, "You know, Teddy, if you had lost, it would have been you that lost. It wouldn't have been your family that lost. You would have lost. You won. You won. Not your family. You." She sat down again. Her outburst lingered in the air. It has lingered in my mind ever since. I'm grateful to her for it. Her message to me was one I needed to hear. Perhaps one I'd yearn to hear. Chapter 23. The Clinton Years, 1992 to 2000. Prior to his election to the presidency in 1992, I didn't really know Bill Clinton. I had met him briefly at the midterm convention in Memphis in 1978, and years later at the funeral of a mutual friend. He had that southern gift of storytelling that kept everyone around him engaged. He didn't forget a name. He loved people. He was a natural politician. After his victory, we established a warm personal relationship. I had longed for a return to a progressive national agenda and was thrilled to see a Democrat back in the White House. A month after his victory, Vicky and I were invited to a dinner in honor of the Clintons at the home of Katherine Graham. It was a hopeful time, and there was much talk of the new agenda. President-elect Clinton said that if he didn't get national health insurance through Congress, he should not be president. Hillary invoked the possibility of tax deductions for educational training programs. Senator Sam Nunn suggested we try a pilot program on national service. Shortly before his inauguration, the president-elect endeared himself to my extended family when he asked us to accompany him to Arlington Cemetery to visit my brother's gravesites. About a year later, President Clinton joined us at the rededication of the John F. Kennedy Library in Boston. I had heard and relished the story he often told of having been inspired to enter politics after meeting Jack at the White House in 1963 as a Boys Nation senator. As we walked through the library together, he was fascinated and wanted to take his time on the tour. He seemed most moved by the Cuban Missile Crisis film, where he sat next to Jackie and asked questions about Jack's mood during that period. He was particularly interested in the Civil Rights exhibit, referring to the historic integration of Little Rock, Arkansas. We agreed about how slow progress had been and how quickly both younger and older generations seemed to have forgotten the struggle that took place. When we reached the exhibit on the Nixon-Kennedy debate, I asked him how he felt during his first debate with President George H.W. Bush. "Nervous at the start," he said, "but then it was like an out-of-body experience. You had to respond to the question and answer it, but you also had to be thinking how it would stack up in terms of the total TV performance." He said he was sure President Kennedy had felt that way too. I'll never forget one of my first meetings with Clinton at the White House. He had walked into a firestorm over the question of whether gays should be allowed to serve in the military. I always thought that if he had laid the groundwork in the right way, he could have changed the policy with the support of the military, and all of the brouhaha would have died down. After all, no less a conservative icon than the retired Senator Barry Goldwater fully supported the repeal of the ban on gays in the military at this juncture. He'd invited all the Democratic members of the Armed Services Committee to this gathering. He went around the room, asking everyone's opinion about gays in the military. Some senators gave long answers. Some were terse. Some were flowery and revealing. And others held their cards close to their vest. It added up to a very lengthy meeting. I remember it well partly because Vicky and I had tickets to the ballet that night. Baryshnikov was dancing at the Warner Theater. I told Vicky to go ahead and that I'd meet her there when I could. But the meeting went on and on and on for more than 2 hours, extraordinary by White House standards. Finally, my turn to speak came. I made a brief comment in support of allowing gays in the military, in which I mentioned that all the arguments against such a policy had already been made, in opposition to blacks and then to women serving in an integrated military. Well, I was wrong about that. Almost all the arguments had been used before. The last senator to speak was Robert Byrd, and he came up with a new one on all of us. Senator Byrd stood up and declared to the president in emotional tones that except for his relationship with his wife, his most sacred possession and thought in this world was his grandson, and that he would never, 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 ever, ever let his grandson go off to the military if we were going to have gays there. And then the senator went off into a long story about Tiberius. He informed us, with many ornate flourishes, that there had been a terrible problem in ancient Rome with young military boys being turned into sex slaves. I don't remember the exact details, but I think the story involved Tiberius Julius Caesar being captured and abused and used as a sex slave. He escaped, and then years later he sought vengeance and killed his captors. Anyway, it was something like that. The room fell silent. The senator continued. By this time, Baryshnikov was leaping and a lot of the Democratic senators were stealing glances at their wristwatches. Then President Clinton stood up.